The Tom Woods Show, episode 2019.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined by Matt Kibbe. It's been a long time since I've had Matt on the program, and since that time, he and his wife Terry have founded Free the People. And I want to actually start off, Matt, before we get into our topic, with having you tell people about Free the People. I saw the merch all over Porkfest.
Yeah, and the idea with Free the People is we wanted to reach young people with the ideas of liberty through storytelling. And what that project quite quickly morphed into a video production crew. So we produce a lot of video content, and we really try to focus on human stories for people, and I call them normal people, people that don't process the world through economic theories. They process the world through their emotions and their friends and their daily lives. And we really think there's an opportunity to reach a massive audience, but we got to sort of get out of our comfort bubble of libertarian philosophy and Austrian economics. And as you know, I love those things, but some people don't.
Yeah, that's true. And especially in this day and age, I just want as many allies as I can get and as many people as possible to listen sympathetically to what we have to say. So whatever works for that, I certainly favor. Let's talk about this paper you wrote. I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/2019 on pandemic socialism. It makes reference to a Hayek book that I think is unfortunately overlooked. I think a lot of people who say they've read Hayek have read The Road to Serfdom and maybe The Constitution of Liberty. But this one, The Counter-Revolution of Science, is not only very important in itself, but is quite applicable to our present situation with COVID and the government response. So how would you describe, what's the basic thesis Hayek's advancing there?
Yeah, and it's important to understand that this book is part of Hayek's broader critique of socialism and central planning and things that we know are more familiar with from Hayek, like the use of knowledge in society and his critique of central planning because you couldn't possibly know enough to reorganize society. But part of it goes back to his critique of what he calls scientism. And that's the misapplication of the process of the natural sciences applied to human action, because as we all know, humans are not atoms and they're not so easy to manipulate. But he saw it as one of the primary problems in socialist planning, because it's sort of that fatal conceit that somehow if you could organize the right people, the super smart people, and we could trust them with all that power, they would be wiser in the reorganizing of society. And it really comes from this sort of pretense that the hard sciences were somehow settled. And if we just gave over the science of human action to those guys, the physicists, the biologists, the engineers, you could somehow recreate society from the top down.
I think we can add to the idea of scientism a phenomenon that we certainly observe today, which is the idea that, let's say, Dr. Fauci or anybody else just sort of begs the question by saying, well, in order to cut down on the number of COVID cases, society needs to do X. But the issue is, okay, well, yeah, okay, if that's our only goal, maybe X will work, although as we've seen, X generally doesn't work anyway. But let's be as generous with them as possible. Let's suppose X does work. It's not an open and shut case that because this will have that effect, that therefore we should do it. The assumption is that the only considerations that matter are the ones that scientists looking at a very narrow slice of human life are talking about right now. But really what we're dealing with is not a scientific question a lot of times, but a philosophical question about what should we prioritize in life. We could shut down all kinds of things that make life worth living and do so indefinitely for years on end. And again, I don't even think that would do much good. But again, supposing that it would, is it an open and shut case that we therefore have to do it because the scientists have said so? Aren't the scientists in a way speaking out of turn if they even so much as imply that we need to do the things that comport with their agenda? Why should we follow their agenda? What makes their agenda more important than mine?
You know, it reminds me of Bastiat's famous view about the seen and the unseen, and at very least, the government scientists and the whole public health industrial complex sort of willfully ignored the potential economic and health damages. And, you know, early on, we were all scolded, those of us that brought up this point, that we were focused on economics and they were focused on human health. Well, of course, these two things are intimately linked together. And that very narrow view that someone like Fauci has, just focusing on a particular virus and not just mitigating the damage of that virus, but actually eliminating it, seems to be his goal, doesn't consider the possibility that, say, you actually did lock everyone into their homes, people would start starving to death if you actually did that in a few weeks, particularly people at the margin. And it seems to be wildly naive, but that has been the paradigm that we've lived through for the last 2 years.
I want to skip ahead to page 12 of your paper. Of course, I don't know if I'm seeing the final published version or not, but anyway, in my version, page 12, this is a passage I remember at the time. I put a chunk of it in my newsletter, and I can tell from reading it that you were as struck by it as I was. This is Dr. Fauci writing in August 2020. He says, "Living in greater harmony with nature will require changes in human behavior as well as other radical changes that may take decades to achieve." So radical changes. And he goes on to give example: rebuilding the infrastructures of human existence, from cities to homes to workplaces, to water and sewer systems, to recreational and gathering venues. In such a transformation, we will need to prioritize changes in those human behaviors that constitute risks for the emergence of infectious diseases. Chief among them are reducing crowding at home, work, and in public places, as well as in minimizing environmental perturbations such as deforestation, intense urbanization, and intensive animal farming. It is a useful, quote-unquote, thought experiment to note that until recent decades and centuries, many deadly pandemic diseases either did not exist or were not significant problems. Cholera, for example, was not known in the West until the late 1700s and became pandemic only because of human crowding and international travel, which allowed new access of the bacteria in regional Asian ecosystems to the unsanitary water and sewer systems that characterized cities throughout the Western world. This realization leads us to suspect that some, and probably very many, of the living improvements achieved over recent centuries come at a high cost that we pay in deadly disease emergencies. Since we cannot return to ancient times, can we at least use lessons from those times to bend modernity in a safer direction? These are questions to be answered by all societies and their leaders, philosophers, builders, and thinkers, and those involved in appreciating and influencing the environmental determinants of human health. Can you just comment on that? What did you think about that?
Probably the most shocking phrase in all of that is he wants to bend modernity and basically erase the last two centuries, which are really those centuries by which free market economics and the market process and entrepreneurship and free people solving problems really lifted us out of a miserable existence where people didn't live long and most people were living in extreme poverty. Part of it is this fantasy of going back to those beautiful early times. But the other part, and this was sort of the trigger of writing this paper in the first place, it reminds me of this guy that I write about, Henry de Saint-Simon, who was the founding father of socialism, very much had this same vision going back to scientism that if we just put guys like Fauci in charge, you know, the biologists and the engineers and the physicists, we could reimagine society from the top down. It is such a dangerous idea. I can't imagine a more dangerous idea. And anytime we've tried anything like it in human history, particularly under experiments in socialism, say the Soviet Union or Mao's China, millions and millions of people starve. So it's, I could imagine a more dangerous idea, but it goes back to his arrogant attitude as a science expert that he could possibly, and he and his colleagues could possibly know how to do such a thing.
There is definitely in the Saint-Simonians, you see, really, there's no other way to describe it, a religious reverence for a priesthood, namely, quote-unquote, scientists, and for science. And again, they treat science unscientifically, like it's some revealed body of knowledge to which we must adhere, as opposed to a procedure that, of course, we should participate in and observe the evolution of. And that is a real problem. Just the other day, I saw, I don't know who the person was, but it was a blue check mark on Twitter saying something like, I just can't understand people who disagree with me about vaccines. I just went to get my booster shot and I was crying tears of joy at my appreciation for science. Now, you know, whatever you want to do, if you feel like the booster shot is a thing you want to do, knock yourself out, go ahead and do it. But this whole, I was crying tears of joy because I was so appreciative of science. Leave aside that the booster shot itself is still actually scientifically controversial as to whether everybody should get it. It was not by any means unanimous. In fact, quite to the contrary, even in the U.S., among the relevant scientists, that there should be a general blanket invitation to everybody to get a booster. None of that nuance, none of that's there. It's like it's a body of knowledge, including everybody has to get the booster. Even when scientists aren't even unanimous on that, that kind of response, it's, I don't want to be uncharitable and sit here and speculate that maybe these are people without meaning in their lives and this fills a void for them. I don't want to psychologize here and be unkind or uncharitable, but it's not flattering seeing stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, going back to the religious metaphor, it's as if he was receiving a sacrament, a holy sacrament, and, you know, wearing a mask is now an act of public piety, and anyone that questions the science, capital T, capital S, is an apostate that needs to be shunned by society. And it all goes back to Saint-Simonism. And I quote in this paper this really bizarre passage from one of his first famous writings where he imagines I'll call it a church of Newton. He calls it a grand council of Newton. And it sort of fetishizes science as this end state thing that we should all worship. And he actually proposes building temples to Newton where people should come and worship. And it sounds insane. And I one of the things I learned rereading The Counter-Revolution of Science is I finally realized why Hayek was so dismissive of Saint-Simon, because I went into reading Saint-Simon wanting to have as sympathetic of a view of socialism and utopian socialism as I possibly could before Marx made it a very violent transition. But as you read it, it just sounds nuts.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And a number of the 19th century socialists, when you read them, like Robert Owen had this idea that under socialism, he just imagined such abundance that the oceans would be converted to lemonade and just crazy things like this. Like what makes them say and think all these sort of crazy things? I feel like 300 years from now, probably much, much sooner than that, but long, long after anybody's vested interests in COVID are gone and nobody feels like they, because these days nobody wants to admit to being wrong about anything. But when all these people are dead and fresh eyes can look at what was done here, at the very least, I feel like after 300 years of progress in science, we have to reach a general conclusion that masks don't, you know, are not a productive intervention. And so they're going to look back on today with all these photos of everybody masked, and the kids in school are going to laugh at this now. So I kind of feel like I hope the Faucis have their fun now, because it's, people are not going to look back and say, wow, look at all these people wisely mitigating the virus. I don't think that's going to be, that's just my prediction. I don't think that'll be the case.
Yeah. And I mean, I tend to be a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. And I have a lot of faith that free people, even with all of these barriers to information and all of the horrible things that governments do to constrain our behavior, that free people work stuff out and we figure stuff out. And that's the whole point of the Hayekian program when he talks about the spontaneous order. you know, that earlier Adam Ferguson called it the wisdom of crowds. And it's just, despite what bureaucrats try to do to us and what politicians and their goons try to do to us, we figure stuff out. But in the meantime, you can create a lot of tremendous damage. And you mentioned something that I want to add. Like when I think about how the world works, and particularly when I'm confronted by something that I don't particularly understand, like a new virus that sounds really dangerous, as we were confronted with in February and March of last year, I always apply two economic filters, two simple ideas that I think are profound. And one is the Hayekian notion of knowledge and whether or not people that want to reorganize things could possibly know enough to do so. But the other is basic public choice theory, that politicians and this whole government ecosystem and everything that feeds on it is self-interested like the rest of us. And that's the other half of this story. The COVID industrial complex is a tremendously lucrative business for just a global network that Fauci basically sits at the top of, although he certainly has competition from the World Health Organization and other places. But this is a guy that essentially controls what gets funded in government research and what doesn't. And that has an effect on the behavior of the entire scientific profession, the entire health, public health profession, pharmaceutical companies, this entire sort of ecosystem that has been promoting pandemic panic since day one.
It reminds me of something Robert Higgs said a number of years ago, and I wish I had the statistic ready at hand, but he was speaking about Homeland Security in the wake of 9/11 as also being big business. And the statistic he had about the number of firms catering to this perceived need just exploding. And you get the sense that probably we could live without almost all these firms. You know, like probably this is overkill, but as with COVID, when people are thinking irrationally, well, you can, unfortunately, the market will cater to that also. Now, you're using the expression pandemic socialism. So when I sat down to read your paper, what I thought it was going to be about was, the various economic interventions that have happened, maybe some of the spending bills or the payments made to people to help support them during a time when they were not able to work and stuff like that. So I thought it was going to be an economic analysis. And then at the end, I realized that I had a much too primitive understanding of what the term pandemic socialism means. Because although there is some, at least implicit reference to effects on economies in this paper, it really is more looking at socialism from the point of view of planning a society. That it's not just capital goods and workers and stuff like that. It's the idea of planning a society in general.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, we all do it. We throw around the word socialism, but the technical definition and the critique that comes from Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek really deals with this idea that you could replace the market process and the price system and local knowledge and the very process of people figuring stuff out with a central plan based on the best ideas of the smartest people. You don't even need to get into the incentive problems and how power corrupts people. But, you know, Mises' original critique was this is impossible. So I'm talking about the very idea, going back to Fauci's dream of bending modernity. I think what Mises would say, well, he would be more generous, but he would say, that's crazy. You can't do it. You couldn't possibly know enough. And trying would be human devastation that you can't even imagine.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Skillshare. You think I'm joking sometimes when I say that it's part of my job to improve your life. But I do improve it, doggone it. And Skillshare is going to improve it further. Skillshare is an online learning community for creative people like you, where millions of people come together to take the next step in their creative journey. It offers thousands of inspiring classes on a variety of topics. And I've given you a few in the past, but we're talking about illustration, graphic design, photography, creative writing, animation, fine art, music and music production, film and video, marketing, productivity, freelance and entrepreneurship, web development, crafts, and more. You think you could find something in there that would enrich your life, take you a little bit out of your comfort zone and open a new door for you? Or did you hear in that list anything you're already kind of good at, but you could be even better? Well, Skillshare has classes for you to fit your schedule and skill level. As a member of Skillshare, you get unlimited access to thousands of classes with hands-on projects and feedback from a community of millions. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods and get a one-month free trial of premium membership. That's a one-month free trial, what have you got to lose, of premium membership at Skillshare when you head to Skillshare.com/woods. Now, again, I want to try to be as charitable as I can be to people who disagree with me on this. I've had several friends I've known in the libertarian world whom I genuinely respect. I really, really respect who think I'm all wrong on this. And, you know, that did actually give me pause because they're smart people and it's not, this isn't just some random guy on social media. So I've come to the conclusion that I probably am, I still think I'm right. And I don't understand why they don't agree with me, but that's okay. But I wonder, I feel like a lot of people who are, let's say, following, you know, Dr. Fauci's every word, some of them are genuinely concerned citizens who have not heard alternative points of view or who have believed the demonization of the people expressing alternative points of view. So I don't think these are all sinister people. But I do think some of them are, in a way, kind of like the religious adepts that we were talking about in terms of 19th century socialism and Saint Simonians. I think for some of them, it is a kind of a devotional thing. And I don't know how you go about getting them out of it. I mean, and so when I say I don't want to be uncharitable, I have sometimes described this phenomenon as a gigantic cult. And I realize that that's not flattering to say about people, that they belong to a cult. But I think, you know, truth has to triumph over politeness in a case like this. And so I wonder, I mean, people do escape cults sometimes. But I wonder what exactly is it that jolts them into realizing that their confidence in a particular person or group of people has been misplaced. And I feel like in this case, what would it take? I mean, these people recommended this thing and that thing and the other thing. And here we are nearly 2 years later, still in the midst of this. You would think that would be enough. Or you can't see your grandmother as she's dying. I wonder what the thing, maybe it's an individual thing. For each person, it'll be different. And maybe some of them will never get out of it. But I don't know. What do you think? This is beyond the scope of your paper.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tipping point, and I actually see a counter-revolution emerging. But they, meaning the planners and the people that want to control our lives and the people that benefit from dramatic expansion of government power and government spending, they found something to scare the daylights out of us. They found our Achilles heel, and it's the fear of an unknown virus. They've tried to scare us with other things much less effectively, I think. But, you know, the war on terror obviously was premised on that same fear. And so there's a pattern here. But I think the only way to jolt people out of it is their own experience. And I think you saw this just the other day with the new fear-mongering campaign about the Omicron variant. Mm. And most people, including people I know that were very much into locking down and shutting down schools and all the things that we've done, are sort of yawning at this one, like, really? Another one? So I think the narrative is starting to fail the scaremongers. And, you know, you're on Twitter, and anybody that's on Twitter can see these massive protests going on all over the world, particularly right now in Austria, where they've now imposed an incredibly draconian lockdown. I think the counter-revolution is coming, and it's based on some pretty simple libertarian principles. We should be free to work and earn a decent living for our families, that everybody is an essential worker and the government shouldn't divide us that way. We should be free to speak our minds. We should be free to move about freely. And I think these are core human values that could in fact be an opportunity to organize people around. And it's a rejection of this kind of COVID socialism that we're seeing. And it's basically a realization that for whatever we accomplished, and I don't think we've accomplished much in the government's efforts to stop this virus, but whatever we've accomplished, we've done so much tremendous damage, particularly to people at the margins, the people that weren't privileged enough to be part of the laptop class. And I think that's an opportunity for all of us, and we should we should approach it with sympathy and empathy and understanding for where people are actually coming from. But those are libertarian principles that people are organizing around.
I've been enjoying seeing the and heartened to see all the footage that you're describing, and I see it in video clips on Twitter. Massive, massive. I saw a huge one in Italy the other day. Massive protests all over the world. And what's kind of strange and hard for me to understand is that if you do opinion polling, it seems like the Europeans are more enthusiastic about these measures than Americans are, although there is a very substantial minority in most European countries opposing the vaccine mandates. It's not just a fringe. There are a lot of people. But I would say of all countries in the world, the one that's most likely to break the back of this whole thing is still the U.S. For all the problems we have, I think we have the most skepticism of authority here, and we have the most rebellious nature. And yet, oddly, it takes different forms here. I haven't seen the truly massive protests in the U.S. that we see in these other European countries, despite the greater rebelliousness and skepticism of authority here. And I'm kind of at a loss to account for that.
Yeah, I am too. And it's frustrating to me because I've always claimed that Americans are sort of genetically predisposed towards liberty. It may be the fact that, you know, unlike countries that are more at the margin where people struggle more to put food on the table, it may be that we're incredibly wealthy and we have been able to shut all of these things down. A lot of us have been able to work from home. And it's probably the case that all of this damage is now finally starting to manifest itself in terms of supply chain shortages, in terms of really high inflation that's probably going to get worse before it gets better. So I think in some ways we're victims of our own success that we were able to do some of these things without hurting as many people as they have in other countries. But the chickens will come home to roost, and I do think Americans will reject that.
It's going to be very interesting to watch the shape of politics over the next couple of years in the U.S. and in Europe, because, as I say, the majority seems to favor the mandates, but it's not a crushing majority. And I wonder if we try to consider the intensity of the support. I think the anti-mandate people are much, much more intensely anti-mandate than the pro-mandate people are pro. And so if you're just looking at the poll numbers, you might think, well, it's an unpopular position for me to be against the mandate. But I think the poll numbers are concealing a rage that mean that these people will vote. You know, whereas the pro-mandate people probably are complacent, or, you know, maybe they believe in it to some degree, but you're talking about people who have their lives ruined, their livelihoods taken away from them. Yeah, even if only 38 to 40% of them, you know, of people in society are saying they're against the mandates, these are people who, I mean, it takes guts to be against these mandates. All of fashionable opinion is in favor of them. So I don't know. I don't know what'll happen, but I don't think it's a loser politically, certainly not in the U.S., to be against it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to take a little bit of political entrepreneurship, and I think Ron DeSantis will definitely emerge as a winner in the political marketplace for sort of pushing against that tide. And you already saw both in Virginia and New Jersey, the gubernatorial races, that was a pretty seismic wave. And as someone that used to do politics, I can tell you that the midterm election coming up, where every member of Congress will be up and a number of senators, midterm elections are low turnout affairs, which means that energy and frustration will probably define those elections. And I suspect that a lot of Republicans who maybe don't deserve to be elected will be elected simply because the Democrats own lockdowns and all of that collateral damage. That doesn't solve the problem, because I'm not sure Republicans, other than a few of them, would know what to do to unwind this, but it does show that there's a grassroots coalition forming that will be very active. And I personally think that it comes from civil libertarians on the left as well as libertarians and constitutional conservatives on the right. You know, it might include people like Glenn Greenwald and Tulsi Gabbard, as well as a lot of people that have fought against this, you know, the Mike Lees and Rand Pauls of the world. And again, it's based on those simple human values. Like, we should be free to leave our houses. We should be free to go into public places. We should be free to speak our mind, even when we raise questions about the official government policies concerning vaccines and mandates. And we should be free to earn a living for our families. These are things that sort of bring that coalition together. And I hope that libertarians are ecumenical enough to say, hey, this is a beautiful opportunity for us to expand the coalition that would apply those same principles to other public policies that we all care about so much.
Well, I am prepared to be Mr. Ecumenical after all this. I am prepared. I'm thrilled to work with people who have seen through this. One more thing. You mentioned Ron DeSantis. One thing I like about him is that sometimes you'll get a politician who now and again does the right thing, but doesn't really understand it that well, or doesn't articulate it, or doesn't say what needs to be said. But DeSantis both does and says what needs to be said. It's just the other day, when talking about the new variant, he was saying, look, let's just face it here. The lockdowns didn't do any good. You know, like, we've done this, we've done that. He was very, very tough about it, saying enough is enough. This is ridiculous. We've all lived through, we can all see with our own eyes that this stuff doesn't do anything. And now they want to roll that out and try that again. They have no idea what they're doing. I mean, he can be tough. He's direct. He knows the studies. He's extremely well briefed, either on his own or by aides. I don't know. But I love that. I love that I listen to him. And yeah, of course, there are issues where he just makes me roll my eyes. Like, the law enforcement stuff is so boomer. I just think, oh yeah, I forgot he's a Republican. Of course, yeah, we're going to get some of that. But when he's good, he's really good. And so, as I say, it's not just that he does the right thing. He also explains himself, you know, in really combative and confrontational ways that the times call for.
You know, people forget that he was part of the Tea Party class of 2010 that brought guys like, I guess Massey came 2 years later. It's ancient history now, but you have that wave that brought in Rand Paul and Mike Lee and Thomas Massey and Justin Amash. And DeSantis was part of that. Obviously, a lot of those guys turned out to be not much better than your typical Republican. But I do think that he does get this right. And to me, political entrepreneurship is not about getting everything right. It's about getting that one thing that is so essential right. And,
yeah.
And I'd love to take him on, like, I'm told that he's pretty lousy on national defense issues and the war on terror. And that's an important issue, too. But I feel like we need to solve this problem and make it so that no politician ever talks about quarantines. Fauci just floated, 7-day quarantines for any American coming back to the U.S.
Even if they have a negative test.
Yeah. And it's like, he's going to go as far as he can go. And until Americans insist that their political leadership push back on that, he's going to get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, I think DeSantis is probably a better governor of Florida than he is president of the United States, because, of course, the things we dislike about him most will come to the fore unless reach him first, I guess.
Well, we should try. Like, I no longer spend my energies educating politicians, because it can be a devastatingly frustrating process. And I'd rather focus on young people that I think are exploring and curious and pushing back against sort of this woke authoritarianism that they're confronted with every day. But of course, that has political consequences. If we can engage the public, and particularly young people, with these values that we hold so dear, I think they're pretty compelling. We just have to meet them on their ground instead of, you know, I could quote Rothbard all day, but maybe that's not the right strategy.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, some things work for some people and other things work for other people. And we have to be, let's say, philosophically and strategically limber enough to be able to distinguish one from the other. So your paper, as I say, I'm going to have linked at tomwoods.com/2019. It's very much worth looking at. It's eerie. The stuff that you dug up, the quotations from Saint-Simon are just, I remember reading some of this stuff years ago, but it's chilling today. So very, very much worth reading. So tomwoods.com/2019 is where to go. And also check out Free the People. What's your website?
Freethepeople.org. And I'll send this to you as well. I'd love to link to a short documentary we did on lockdowns about a family in Brooklyn. It's called All We Have. And it's the struggle about a mom and pop restaurant who are facing losing everything, including their son, because of Andrew Cuomo's lockdowns.
Oh, my goodness. Definitely, I will link to that. So now everybody, go now use my tomwoods.com/2019 link for sure, because this sounds like right up my alley. I'm sorry I haven't seen this yet, but I look forward to seeing it. Well, thanks very much, Matt. Always great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow, we've got Tony Lyons, who is the president and publisher of Skyhorse Publishing, which is the publishing house that published the brand new book by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called The Real Anthony Fauci. And they have just had one obstacle after another when it comes to getting the word out about that book. So we're going to get the inside story about that. And remember, too, if you missed the footage of the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, I'm telling you, you're in for some really, really enjoyable entertainment. You can get the videos at tomwoods.com/2000. So head on over there. Make some popcorn, have an enjoyable evening of entertainment. You're really going to love it. It's so much fun, so many laughs. So tomwoods.com/2000. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.